This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 439 for October 19th of 2018, Gearheads Talking Flatheads. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us for Out of Line After Hours. Special you, Gary.
Hi,
good to have you here.
I missed the show last week when you guys were doing the Ford Edge out in Park City, I think you guys were.
Yeah, Park City, Utah.
Yeah, and it feels like Park City, Utah out there right now.
It's a lot chillier here than it was a week ago.
Indeed.
That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Hey, we got to let everybody know that Steve Purdy is joining us. He's with Shunpiker Productions, which puts out the Shunpiker Journal.
That's
Steve,
right.
Great to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure indeed.
So explain Shunpiker. There's a meaning behind that.
Yeah, Shunpiker, for those who don't know that term, is one who shuns the turnpike, takes the back road instead of the highway. Hmm. So a lot of what I do is focused on road trips and back road kind of stories and places you don't often go and see, but always with an automotive element there.
You're probably dating yourself saying the word turnpike.
Turnpike, that's true. The highway, staying off the major highway.
Yeah, well, turnpike tends to be more of an East Coast kind of term.
Yeah,
I don't even know
true.
If they use it there anymore.
Yeah, probably not.
You're an old rallier too, right?
Well, yes, I've done
Press On Regardless Rally.
Well, I covered the POR a few times. Okay. I rode through a few press stages that. Kind of.
You're still recovering from?
Oh, yes, that's for sure. But yeah, I did the One Lap of America rally 7 times as well.
Wow.
So that was a lot of miles. Mm-hmm. And we never did very well, except for 1 year when we had a really highly skilled computer guy as our navigator. But boy, you know, put me behind a wheel, but don't put me in a column of figures trying to calculate time, speed, and distance.
So when you did the one lap, did you go on the turnpike?
Oh, yes, we sure did. Well, let me tell you quickly, the route instructions for the first one, we left from Darien, Connecticut, and the route instructions said go to Boston, turn left, to Seattle, turn left, to San Diego, turn left, to Miami, turn left, and back to the start. That was the route instructions. And if you stayed on the freeway and went along at a pretty good clip, you could have time for a shower when you got to the next turn and just kept going. So, yeah.
That's great. But our special guest today is Craig Cole from AutoGuide.
Special.
You're the guest, man. You're sitting in the guest chair.
Oh, is this? I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Oh, I was over there last time.
Yeah.
That's right.
Oh.
You weren't special.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we made you special for this
thank
show.
Thank you.
Because
I
you brought
honored.
Stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
Props and goodies and a giant hunk of pig iron.
And we're going to talk about that. In fact, we're going to be talking about the Ford Flathead V8. And if you all who are watching would like to get in on the discussion, send us an email with your question. Shoot it to viewermail at autoline.tv. We'll also take phone calls. That number is 620-288-6546. And if you're outside of the U.S. to make that call, it's, what, plus 0011, whatever. So if you guys figure it out. But back to the show. What got you to be a fanatic, I guess, a fan of the Ford Flathead V8.
I don't actually know. I think I'm just an old soul, right? Because I've always loved old cars, like old cars from the 30s especially. They just look so cool. Nothing's like that today. I think the styling back in that era was really different. Each brand you could sort of tell apart, where today you put a midsize sedan profile out there and you don't know what car. Is it a Corolla? Is it a Honda, you don't know. I mean, everything kind of looks the same. But back then, big differentiation. And I was fortunate enough to be able to restore a 1936 Ford, which I was going to drive today to bring in studio, but I had to go to an event this morning and just with the rush hour.
Yeah.
I didn't want to deal with it.
Yeah,
so
right.
I brought the engine block instead.
So you took it out?
Yeah, no. This is one of my spares.
Oh. So how many spares do you have?
I have, more than I'd care to admit, probably 6 or 7.
Because they full do, engines?
Well, yeah, that have been torn down, but most of them are down to bare blocks like this because they have to take them out and get them hot tanked, basically cleaned out, and then checked for cracks because they are notorious for cracking, which can be fatal.
Why? Why do they crack?
Well, a lot of times they run very hot, which is something we'll probably get to in a minute here. But they run hot, and then also between the two valves, you've got alternating hot and cold, and that can tend to stress the metal there. Also, if you get a steam pocket under the valves there, it'll crack because it'll be superheated. You're not getting the coolant flowing through that area, and it can crack.
This engine came out when?
1932. I believe March of 32 is when they announced it.
It's not the first V8.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, Chevrolet had one in like 1917 with overhead valves.
Yeah, Chevy or Cadillac?
Chevrolet.
Really?
Chevrolet had an overhead valve.
But this could be the Ford flathead is the first mass production V8,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's the key. It's the first popularly priced V8, if you will. And it really, it was a response... really to Chevrolet, because in 29 they came out with a straight six that was the price of a four-cylinder. And Henry Ford was not going to allow that. He loathed the straight six from a car that he built many years ago. He hated the engine for whatever reason. I guess it would rip up the transmission. So he never liked the straight six, so he's like, we're going to come out with a V8. We're going to two-up Chevrolet.
But didn't he not want to have a V8? That his son had said at one point, we need to have a V8.
I'm not sure about. I think Edsel would have gone six instead.
Here we got a picture. That's not your.
That's a 32.
You got a four door.
I do.
You not
it's
right?
A 36.
Okay.
There you.
There's
go.
Your car. Whoa, that's, that is a good looking car.
Isn't that pretty?
Mm-hmm.
No kidding.
And every nut, bolt, bracket, component, everything's been gone through, and I've refurbished, cleaned, replaced. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
But. I'll bet you could do this blindfolded, right?
They're fairly
straightforward.
Yes, they're fairly simple. And, I brought a bunch of components we can talk about later. But the real heart of the engine, the real innovation that Ford did was the block itself.
I always heard, you can confirm this, I hope, that they could not cast this.
Right.
And Henry was out there with practically a whip.
One out of two.
Keep going at it.
Yes. One out of two had to be thrown away.
Yes.
Yeah. Melted down again because they failed before they got to the car.
Is that right?
Yeah,
how did they fail?
The cracks, mostly, I think.
The cores would shift and the block would be useless. I mean, if you bore it out and you hit water, what good are you? You got to send it back and scrap it. So the big innovation here, prior to the flathead V8, every V8 was found pretty much in luxury cars, high-priced vehicles. And that's partly because they had to make them in separate pieces. They didn't have the foundry technology to do them in one single block.
Whereas the others were, castings that were bolted together.
Well, you'd have a crankcase,
and then you'd have a separate casting with the cylinders and then the intake and everything. So you'd have to machine all those surfaces. You'd have to hold those tolerances, and you have to assemble it. So there's all this work that goes into it. Henry Ford, through sheer force of will, I guess, got them, Charlie Sorensen, his cast iron Charlie, one of his engineers, to design this engine and produce it and get it reliably done in one go, which brought the cost down enough that they could put it in a low price car to compete with Chevrolet.
Sorensen was a manufacturing genius.
Yes. Yes.
You know, everybody gives Henry the credit with inventing the moving assembly line. It's probably Charlie Sorensen.
Yeah, and I mean, even like Oldsmobile was doing.
Or R.E. Olds did it before Henry Ford did.
And didn't his factory, was it in Flint?
It was in Detroit, and it burned down.
Yes. Right.
And that's when he moved to Lansing. So
this
now
is Ransom Olds.
Ransom Olds, R.E. Olds, yeah. And Henry Ford worked for R.E. Olds.
Before
he established his second company.
Huh?
He worked for R.E.
He had three goes at the auto industry, right?
At least.
Who gets one chance?
And I understand that this the flathead V8 was one of the last automotive components that Henry Ford oversaw before he moved on to all the other things that interested him in life in the mid-30s. But this was one of his last projects. And that he had four teams working on it at one time. One team would come up with something he didn't like, so he'd just dissolve them and start another team. He didn't even keep what was good. Yeah. So it was quite a story.
He was an eccentric guy,
to say the least. A bit of a tyrant.
But the block is the real foundation, and that's the innovation. They had something like, I want to say, 50-ish sand cores that you have to line up when you're setting the mold up. And they brought a picture up. So you can see all of those bits of sand. They're carefully molded. That's like a negative. That's the reverse of the engine. So wherever there's a sand core, when you pour the liquid, the molten cast iron into the mold, that's where there's no metal. So basically, the water jackets, the intake ports, everything. So you have to make all of those in reverse to be able to manufacture the engine, which can you imagine trying to figure that out with a slide rule and everything?
Mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Hey, we got some questions here.
Oh, already, wow.
Dan Neal.
Okay.
The Dan Neal wrote in to ask, is it true that Henry kind of sabotaged his own engine?
I'm not sure about
which
that.
Which goes sabotage. My point.
Why would he sabotage his
Because he didn't want to do V8.
Yeah, and he didn't want somebody else's idea to succeed, maybe, although it was, I mean, he worked on it, so. But, you know, he was so eccentric that I guess I wouldn't doubt that, you know. He was,
well, it sounds like, from what you're saying, maybe he was against it at first.
Right, and then somehow he got sold on it. Edsel, or somebody, sold him on the idea.
Well, they were working on an air-cooled X-8 at one point.
That's right, yeah.
Which I can't imagine. It's almost like a radial aircraft engine of sorts. Yeah. But I know with the flathead, initially he wanted it without an oil pump and without water pumps. Because just like the Model T, it kept costs down. It was very simple, easy to maintain. But... because of the...
Can you imagine the cracking problem that it had because of, the cooling was bad? And
we didn't need a water pump.
Either.
It's just like...
That's why it has full pressure lubrication. And not one, but two water pumps.
Why?
Look on the front of the block, you'll see a couple giant holes. That's where the pumps bolt to. And, well, very important reason, John, because these are notorious for running hot. And if you look at the way the valve train is arranged and the way the gases flow into and out of the engine, you can see on top, those are the intake ports. Mm-hmm. The air and the fuel flows into that, up, down, into the cylinder, very torturous path, which is why these engines do not breathe very well and make very much power. But that's another story. But when once you've had your power stroke and the air and fuel has been burned, it's got to exit through another exhaust valve, and it routes around and into the block. So these hot exhaust gases are being dumped right into a water jacket, very first thing, which obviously puts an enormous strain on the cooling system. Mm-hmm. They had something like my car is 5.5-6 gallons of coolant in the whole system. It's just huge. And that's just to keep the temperatures in check because they routed those exhaust ports right through the block.
Okay, but is your cooling system stock? I mean, or is that something that came about later in the life of this thing? I mean, the engine ran for 21 years, so modifications were made.
Yes. So I'm running, this is in sort of a mid-range production block. So this would have been like 46, probably 48, somewhere in that range. And they made a number of improvements to it. The early engines were 21 stud, they were called. There were 21 studs that held the cylinder heads down to the deck. And they also had the water pumps mounted up on the cylinder head. So they were trying to suck hot coolant out of the block, which didn't work so well. It would just lower the pressure inside the block in that area and could cause more overheating. So with the mid-range block, they added 24 studs per head instead of 21, and they moved the water pumps down to the block where they would force cool water into the engine rather than trying to suck it out, which did help a lot with the overheating issue. But a major reason, another one that they overheated, they didn't do a very good job knocking the core sand out. I've taken engines apart, and the back two cylinders are half filled with sand still, aside from all the rust and scale and other crap in there. I've pulled pieces of rusty wire out that they use to hold the sand cores inside the mold.
That sounds like bad quality control.
They just didn't. Yeah, they didn't care.
You know what it sounds like to me? Souvenirs.
I'll bring you some rusty wire next time, Gary.
Put it in a frame.
Yeah, that's right.
Dave Tuttle has just written in to ask, what were the other technology, design, or manufacturing breakthroughs that finally made the flathead viable? Metallurgy, casting techniques, milling, block design features, pistons or rings?
I think the big thing was the casting technology, to be able to make it in one piece and save all of that machining and assembly time. That was the big achievement with this engine. Obviously, there are trade-offs to the design, but they eventually ironed everything out, and this was in production for 21 years at Ford, a year later in Canada up until 54, and then they actually used the 85-horsepower block, which is the standard size, up until, I think, like 1991 in France, actually. They put them in army trucks. And if you can get a French flathead block, they're the best because they have the highest, they have more advanced metallurgy, they have better casting techniques, they knocked all the sand out. And they're just, they've benefited from all that experience, decades of making them.
Dan Neal wrote back to clarify. He says, I mean by insisting on unworkable ideas, such as bad gas flow and bad coolant flow. But he also asks a really good question here. Why are we celebrating this hunk of junk? Why has this engine persisted?
Well, I can give you one reason.
Why, Steve?
I think one of the reasons is that this is the engine that sort of defined the hot rodding in the early days. After World War II, when everybody was excited about cars and you couldn't get a new car, you know, these California guys would just build their own cars, and there were more flathead V8s around
than just about anything else. That was
else.
70 years ago, damn near.
Oh, and why are we celebrating it? Well, because of its historical significance.
Yeah, I know, but there's other historical engines, right?
Well,
and,
sure.
And there's people, more, a lot of people like
cool.
Craig who are cool.
You know, we don't know them.
Cool.
We know him.
Yeah. And you know I'm not cool. But to why do we celebrate? I don't know. It's nostalgia. It feels good inside.
Well, but it is significant from the point, as mm-hmm. you noted earlier, that this became the first V8 that was mass-produced and mm-hmm. affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so in that regard, it's significant. Now, the other thing is the crankshaft, as you may be familiar with. That mm-hmm. This was an innovation that the other vehicles had used forged steel,
mm-hmm.
and he did cast steel.
Well, I think initially some of them were forged, but eventually.
But then he decided that he needed
for cost.
He ended up doing this heat treating of mm-hmm. the steel and machining it cheaper than doing it forged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could ask our friends at Ward's why it's such a significant engine. They named it one of the 10 best, most important engines of the 20th century, means of automotive history, essentially.
Think about this. When it first came out in 32, it had 65 horsepower. They made a couple changes in 33. They got it up to 75. By 34, it had 85, which is about where it would stay. So conceivably, when one of those early V8 Fords came out, you might be driving a Model A with half the horsepower. You might still be driving a Model T even at that point. And to have a car that would do 75 miles an hour or more, that's a revelation, right? A car that's reliable, fast, smooth, quiet. People fell in love with the V8.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, what's always impressed me, too, is people like you and others keep figuring out ways of improving the engine. In fact, we should talk about Zora Arkas Duntov, mm-hmm. father of the Corvette, actually designed heads for the flathead.
Yeah. They call them Arden heads.
Arden heads.
I guess that's a portmanteau of his name, Arkas Duntov, Arden. And they were like Hemi heads, and they're massive. You see them on an engine, they're like... But he figured a way of blocking off the intake and exhaust ports and running overhead valves and getting a lot more power out of it. Brilliant engineering.
It's an interesting example of how people show up in different companies throughout automotive history. Think of the Dodge brothers and Henry Ford and mm-hmm. Henry Leland, people like that. Well, here you've got Zora Arkas Duntov and his brother Yara building this conversion for the flathead Ford, and then later creates the Corvette for General Motors.
So, okay, Steve, to your point earlier about celebrating this because of the hot rodding history. Did the hot rodders glom onto that engine because it was widely available, or was there some characteristic of the way the architecture made it more amenable to them?
I think it was compact enough to fit where they wanted it to fit, and you could do a lot with it. But the other element there is that when all these guys wanted to use the flathead, then companies started developing aftermarket alterations for it, the heads, mm-hmm. Blowers, all kinds of stuff were developed. You know, aftermarket accessories were developed for that engine. So, you know, its popularity sort of fed on itself. Because it was so popular, people would build all these aftermarket things for it. And then so that made it even more desirable, I think.
It was the hot thing of the time, too.
Of the day,
there was no LS swap. Right.
Yeah. In the early 50s.
You had one of these.
And then, of course, when Ford and Chevrolet made their small block V8s, overhead valve V8s, then interest in these waned a bit. Mm-hmm. But now, because of nostalgia, I suppose, everybody's going back to them. In fact, my brother is a hot rodder in Florida, and his daily driver is a 32 Ford pickup with a flathead, 48 flathead Mercury. And his son, who's an engineer for GM, has two of them. He's got a 32 sedan
and a
32 Roadster. And he's with that technology. So here you've got two guys in modern times, one of them a youngster, just love that flathead V8.
Others have said, too, the exhaust note that they really like. Is that true?
Oh, it's it's sort of the shuffling, like syncopated, I don't know if that's the right word, but this sort of rhythm to them because of the way the exhaust ports are arranged. They go into the block, which kind of muffles it a little bit. Low compression, too. You're not making a lot of power to begin with. But then on each bank, the center two cylinders, they share a common exhaust port. So those are, there's sort of a, it just gives it this interesting character that you don't hear in any other engine.
Right.
It definitely sounds like a V8, but something different. Yeah.
When I was a kid, you could always tell the difference between a Ford and any other car driving down the road because of that distinctive sound.
Mm-hmm. It was sort of the flathead.
I assume it was the flathead because it was always Fords that sounded that way, or sort of a yin, 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 yin sort of sound.
is that how your engine sounds?
I would not describe it as a yin, yin, yin.
No.
But they're very distinctive, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Okay, we got some more people writing in. Kit Gerhardt says, affordable performance in 1932. That's why we celebrate the Ford flathead.
Amen.
Yeah. Yes. Rear-wheel drive, please, says Ford flathead footstool. I think he's looking at it.
Yeah, it's just a
cool,
right,
cool
height,
table,
right?
Man. You want to leave it here. We'll put a glass top on it.
Yep, I've seen coffee tables like that. They're great.
And he also writes in to say 50% rejection rate is pretty good considering it was the 30s and the complexity.
Yeah.
And then he also adds, Henry was against anything that wasn't the Model T. that was true for a long time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like they had to beg him to introduce the Model A, right?
So you brought a bunch of components.
Yes, they did.
So, you know, what's notable about some of these things?
All right, well,
you got pistons and.
So this is a piston. This would have been out of one of the latter series engines, probably 52 or 53, but it's basically the same for all years. You can see the rings are quite thick. And this engine was run to death. The ring lands are blown out. This has worked really hard. But it also has four rings. They added a secondary ring at
the very bottom of the piston. You see another ring. That was what, for reducing oil consumption? Or
they did have oil consumption issues, which we can get to with the valve guide here in a minute. But yeah, they were trying to. It also, they thought it stabilized the piston in the bore. Honestly, if people are rebuilding an engine today, you just leave the fourth ring off. You don't need it. It's just an extra piece. It's extra mass. It's extra cost. Forget it. It does nothing.
Finally, it's okay to put an engine together and have pieces left over.
Yes, exactly.
And is the mass really an issue?
Gary, you're making 85 horsepower, all right? Which, I mean, you could relatively easily double the output, too, with the hot heads, fuel intake.
All the accessories.
Yeah,
show
us
the valves, because that's really interesting. You have an integrated spring on it.
Yeah, so the idea with these valves, the idea was that it was an entire unit. There would be a keeper on the bottom. I have it off right now because I can't compress the spring enough by hand to get it off to show you guys. But the idea was that you would drop these assemblies right into the block, and then you would take a long lever with like a fork on the end. You'd pull the guide down just a little bit, and that would put tension on the spring. You'd drop what's called a horseshoe clip in, and that would hold the whole assembly in the block then.
Hmm.
And this is...
That's pretty clever, actually.
It is. So it's very, in theory, easy to service, but a lot of times the valve guides will get stuck in there with rust or, you know, the oil they had back in the day was not very good, so it would gum up everything. Hmm. But this is an early valve. And if you notice, it's got a mushroom tip on the end. They thought it would make it quieter when it was running against the lifter. Dubious claim, I think. Doesn't really matter. But so how do you have a valve guide with a mushroom tip, then? How do you get the valve through the guide? It's the big question, right? Well, it's a very easy answer. You have a split guide.
Oh, look at that.
See there. But the idea was this would be for quieter running. Ultimately, they phased it out and just went with a straight, you know, typical.
The way we do it today,
exactly,
pretty much.
And a solid guide. But it's interesting because these tend to, on the intake at least, suck some oil past there, which is where some of the oil consumption does come from. But interesting, it also had solid lifters. So in the early days, what you would do, you would lap your valves and everything, have the valve seats cut, lap them. And when you drop the valve assemblies in, they'd all be at different heights. And you need a prescribed, you know, clearance between the lifter and the valve. So you'd have to either weld material on the end of the valve to close it up or machine it down to get the latch set correctly.
What a hassle.
But the idea is, and the good thing is, once you do that, it's pretty much set for life. Okay. Until the next rebuild.
Yeah, but I'm talking at the manufacturing plant. That means you need stacks of valves and lifters.
And they would probably select sort them, and then they have exactly the size, drop it in, and go. Huh. So the early lifters were solid. This happens to be a later one, but it's you get the idea. It's a solid lifter.
Yeah.
The aftermarket, brilliant. An adjustable lifter. It's got a nut on there. So you put your feeler gauge in, you adjust it to 14 thousandths or whatever it is. Done. Walk away. No grinding, no welding. Easy.
And it seems to have the same mushroom design.
A little bit, yeah.
Let's see the ignition that
This is a distributor. Cool, it's called a Crab style. This would have been from about 1942. It's the style that I run on my car because it's the easiest to deal with. You can see the cap goes on just like that. And
that's a wild-looking distributor cap.
Yeah, that's why they call it the crab.
It looks like a crab.
So each plug lead runs out of there, runs to the appropriate cylinder. But it's very clever. It's got dual points inside. One half of the points controls when the spark plugs fire, as you would expect in a typical modern distributor. But the other one also opens up a little bit after the spark plug fires, which gives the coil a little bit more time to saturate. So it's got more
juice. Explain that more, because I don't fully understand.
So the one side fires the plug, but immediately after that fires, the other set of points opens, which basically it's just giving the coil more time to juice
to recharge.
Basically, exactly, which is a very clever idea. You could do it easily with just one set of points, but they added two just to go the extra mile. They're very reliable, smooth-running engines that worked well for many years. And this distributor, I was telling you earlier, John, it's got centrifugal advance for the timing, but it also has a vacuum brake. So there's a piston in here with a spring. And under light loads, you're going to have higher engine vacuum, right? So that vacuum is going to keep that piston sucked up against the tension of the spring. But as you get on the throttle, engine vacuum drops. So the spring overcomes that, and it will actually push that piston down against part of the advance mechanism. It will retard the timing. So if you've got bad gas or something, or you live in a mountainous area, you're climbing a hill, it's hot out, you can adjust this screw on the top, which changes the tension on the spring and prevents spark knock.
Who needs electronic engine controllers?
Oh, wow.
Easy.
So what's with the connecting rod?
Connecting rod? I just brought it in because it's kind of frail looking, but it should be, it's pretty light. It's they're very strong, though. They are forgings, I believe manganese steel forgings. Huh. So the hot rodders would use these really without issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can get like Eagle or Scat rods today with H-beam design, I-beam design.
Yeah.
If you want to go crazy. But in an engine with three main bearings.
Is that all?
That's all.
For a V8.
Yeah, that's all you need, really. But
with 85 horsepower, sure.
So why did he just go with three?
Less friction. It's a fuel economy play.
Interesting.
No,
even in those days. So
in
spite of the flathead's limitations and heat dissipation and breathing and so forth, it must have been a pretty dependable engine to have lasted
dependable.
That long.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you weren't driving it too hard, it would last and be very easily repairable.
So in other words, if you didn't crack the block, you'd be all set.
Yes. Yeah. And really, the overheating isn't so much an issue these days. If you get the sand and the scale and the rust out of the block, you're well ahead. Also, if you run coolant, so it doesn't, antifreeze, so it doesn't rust further, you're ahead. You can get a pressurized radiator. You get these things, you really don't have to worry.
Amado Arceo from Saginaw writes in to point out, and I'm sure you know this story, John Dillinger said his favorite car was a Ford because it had the flathead V8 that could outrun the police with their inline six-cylinder Chevys, right?
Yeah, or like Dodge and Plymouth had a flathead straight six, bulletproof, but very lethargic from what I've read. I haven't actually driven one.
I haven't either, but that's the case. And here Henry Ford developed this engine to compete with Chevrolet, who had beaten his pants the year before.
Yes.
So now it just took a year or two, and that started out selling Chevrolet.
Yeah.
So it was a success in that respect.
We're getting out to the end of this, but we got to squeeze this in. Andy G. writes in from the Philippines, wants to know, does anyone build new flathead V8s, like there are new 302 and 351 crate engines?
Not yet. I see online there's a guy that's working on doing that, but he's like some CNC engineer or something. Yeah. I don't know. And
there was a guy out at the Points and Condenser Preservation Society a few years ago from, I believe he was from Troy, that's working on that very thing, and he had a one-off sort of example of it. It was really magnificent.
And last question here, Everett Mish says, was it Henry that pushed the flathead versus overhead valve, to keep it simple?
It was all simplicity, I would say. They were familiar with flathead from the Model T, from the Model A, and it was easy enough for them to sort of put two inline fours together. That's not exactly what it is. There are a lot of differences, but in theory, that's what it is, basically. And they were, I mean, and at the time, the gasoline was of low octane, right? Very low quality.
Right.
So would an engine even be able to really take advantage?
What's the compression ratio?
I was anywhere from 5 to 7 to 1.
Right,
I mean,
there.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the gasoline was of low quality. Yeah. And like Chevrolet had the inline six with overhead valves. I would argue that was sort of a paper tiger because you can't, the engine can't really rev. It did not have full pressure lubrication. It had these sort of oil jets that would spray at these dippers on the connecting rods. It's just crazy. At least this had full pressure lubrication.
Real good. Well, look, we're going to have to take a quick break right now. Steve, you're going to be leaving us momentarily, but we're going to get you back after a second break. We're going to have Sean McElroy come in and talk about some stuff that he saw at Honda. But first, a shout-out to our friends at BorgWarner.
The world is changing at an ever-increasing pace. No matter what the mode of transportation, there is always the need for an efficient propulsion system. And that's exactly what BorgWarner has been doing since the earliest days of the automotive industry. We create innovative mobility technologies that reduce energy consumption and emissions while improving performance. Our proven track record has made us an industry leader in forward-looking propulsion solutions for combustion, hybrid, and electric vehicles.
Okay, we're all back here talking about things on Autoline After Hours. Now, Sean's joining us. Good to have you on board.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So you went, was it this week or last week, to some event Honda had?
It was week before.
And they're calling it their smart intersection?
Exactly right, yeah.
What's it about?
Well, they're just trying to take connected vehicles and be able to warn them of things that they wouldn't be able to normally see. They took an intersection in Marysville, Ohio, not far from their factory there, and it was a somewhat unique corner that there's buildings on all four corners. So being able to see around the corner would be difficult, or they were also showing how the system could detect emergency vehicles or a vehicle that might run a red light. And the way they were doing that is on the top of the lights, the traffic lights, they had cameras up there. There were cameras on each four corners, and those cameras would shoot down and they would survey the area, try and see what was there, if there was a pedestrian that might be walking across the street or whatever. And it would, the camera would take that and they'd send it down into a computer. Now, the computer in this case was a big black box that they had set up on the corner of the intersection. And the computer then would take what it's getting from the camera, and the computer would determine, is it a person? Is it a vehicle? Is it an emergency vehicle? And then they could determine from there and then send that back up to a radio that was also on top of the traffic light. And then that information would be sent down to the connected vehicle, and that would be displayed on the head-up display for the driver to see. And it would say, warning, keep your eye out for pedestrians, or whatever it was going to say, and then the driver could take action from there.
Did it work?
Yeah, it worked really well. They put us in three scenarios, the what I was talking about, pedestrian, emergency vehicle, and a vehicle running a red light. And even before we came up to the corner, we were making a right-hand turn for the pedestrian, and the pedestrian would come across the street, and it would say, hey, keep an eye out, before you could even see that person. And the same with the car running the red light or the emergency vehicle. Before you could ever see it in the inside the car, it was coming up with that.
So did Honda make an argument as to why that might be a better approach than having cars and emergency vehicles talk to cars, rather than using the infrastructure, having each individual, you know, so V to V rather than V to X?
Yeah, I mean, in V to V, you're not going to take into consideration pedestrians. And I also kind of look at it like this. They always talk about, in the airline industry, redundancy of systems. You know, if something fails, or a sensor could be dirty, or, you know, the communication to the vehicle might be down, between vehicles might be down, or something like that. I just look at it as another data point for the car to have mm-hmm. for something to, you know, if something's going to mm-hmm. go wrong, why not have as much data as you possibly can have?
Right. Because I was out at Continental Automotive, as Seamus was, another McElroy.
Too many McElroys.
And we did a V to V demonstration, and it's remarkable how simple the system really is. I mean, basically all they need is an ECU, an antenna, and a radio. And, you know, it was we did a demonstration where there was a car hidden behind a curve and how the warning came up because, you know, the car was stalled
right
beyond the curve. And it's just like you couldn't see it visually and bang, you knew ahead of time.
How did it warn you? Or?
Yeah, a warning right on the cluster and audibly, you know, beep, 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 beep.
Yeah. What about tying in the brakes or anything like that?
They said that would be another step. Yeah, that it was technically feasible, not a problem whatsoever. Okay. Because the other thing was like how emergency braking is going to become, you know, they said it's not going to be a requirement, but by 2022, 20 major automakers have committed to putting it on cars across the board. And so you think
automated about, emergency braking,
correct?
Is, right.
And so you think about something like that and tie that into, you know, information, whether it's, you know, on a street light or a traffic signal and put it in the car.
Yeah, the other thing that V2V might not catch is, you know, another vehicle may not, if someone's walking across the street, let's say, and there's another vehicle around, maybe it's already gone past that person. So you're the first one coming up to it.
Right.
So you might be able to, you know, warn another vehicle behind you at that point,
mm-hmm.
which would also be another reason why
sure.
they were doing that test.
Mm-hmm.
How are all of these things communicating? Is it Wi-Fi, Bluetooth? Is it using cellular service? How does it actually talk?
They were using a cellular service. They were using DSRC, dedicated short-range communication. And they talked about, you know, possibly 5G as well coming up. Mm-hmm. But they were saying that that's what's available now. It's been tested, you know, military to military standards. So that's what they had. If 5G comes along and proves it's better, they could always switch over to that as well. But they just wanted to test the system now.
So did they say, I mean, is this fundamentally going to be the responsibility of municipalities to put this stuff in, or would car makers do it? I mean,
I think that's still part of the test that, from there, you've got to come up with some sort of regulation. How do you regulate the systems and all that, too? But
yeah, my I've been a big proponent of DSRC. I don't think it's going to survive for the very reason that you raised, Gary. It is pretty much municipalities, counties, states that have got to put in all this infrastructure. None of them have the money to do it.
This is after they put the charging stations in, by
right.
the way.
We gotta, and so the telcos, the telephone companies, have all been pushing for 5G. However, I just learned last weekend that at CES there's going to be a major announcement of using 4G, but it's like some special aspect of 4G. That
4.5G.
4.5G, there you go. Or 4.27.
There you go.
Right.
4G.
It's the flathead version.
There you go.
But
it's 1G.
But the infrastructure is already out there. All you'd have to do is incorporate it into cars as well. And even if it ultimately goes to 5G, the telcos are going to make all this investment. And so, besides the internet providers all want that bandwidth that DSRC takes.
What do the telcos want in exchange for doing all this?
Well,
want your data or what?
No, like, well, not necessarily. Everything's got to be routed through their stuff. So, yeah, they're going to, you know, slice off fractions of a penny, but it all adds up. DSRC is beautiful in that, you know, it's free, essentially. Once the municipalities or whoever puts in, you know, wires all the intersections. And that's been one of the objections to going to 5G is, oh, my God, you know, now the telcos get all the money.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also interesting, and we've reported this on Autoline Daily, Qualcomm has come up with a chipset that handles both DSRC and 5G. So they're sort of hedging their bets whichever way it goes. The beauty of the system is, though, this could have a dramatic improvement in safety. Car to car, car to pedestrian, whatever.
But what was Honda's big argument? I mean, why were they saying that they thought this was a way to go?
in just for the test itself? Or
yeah, I mean, why are they doing it? I mean, is it a safety play or is it?
Oh, yeah, definitely a safety play. Plus, there's still it. I mean, obviously, it's still in its infancy, so they want. There's still a whole lot more to learn. They talked about, weather conditions as well, and that's one thing that I wonder, too, is, like, how is everything? I mean, obviously, the communication doesn't care about weather, but cameras definitely care about weather. Mm-hmm. And I think there's still just a whole lot more that they can learn from it. And they also brought up the aspect of regulation, you know, where, you know, who's going to be at fault if something happens, and how do you regulate the system itself? So there's still a whole lot more to learn, and I think that's part of it as well. But safety is definitely a big play.
So this was in downtown Marysville.
Downtown Marysville, yeah.
Okay, and you guys got a demo. I mean, is it there? So you did the demo last week or the week before, it doesn't matter. Is it there right now?
Yeah. Yep. And it had been there for several months as well.
And are there just special cars that Honda has engineered that can make use
Yeah,
of
they it. Said that there are Honda cars, and there's also other vehicles within this fleet of vehicles that they will have, and I think it's going to be up to 200 or so that are connected, mm-hmm. connected cars that can go through the intersection and get these warnings.
See, it'd be interesting. So Cadillac offers V2V right now, and so Which would make the argument that basically since only Cadillac offers V2V, that only Cadillacs can talk to Cadillacs, right?
Correct.
But the question is, if you have V2V on your car, does it also talk to the infrastructure? So maybe if a Cadillac goes rolling through Marysville, it could get the information.
It would just catch on fire. It's Honda Town.
I don't think
it would have to have the exact same protocols, which it may well have, of what Honda put up there. But I got to tell you, I General Motors gave me a V2V demonstration that knocked my socks off, I want to say in 2004 at a proving grounds. Mm. They thought it would be in production by 2012. But then this thing happened called the Great Recession, and GM went bankrupt. But that's one of the reasons why Cadillac's got the system. But it's a DSRC system. Much of Ann Arbor is already wired for this kind of communication. And I want to say they've done it through the OBD2 port. And it may not be as grandiose as what Honda showed you in Marysville, but there's a lot of intersections and I want to say as many as 10,000 cars that have signed up for the service in Ann Arbor.
So you just plug a little module into the port?
Correct.
And it works?
Right. Mm. Now, it will not do automated emergency braking, but it will give you warnings that somebody that you can't see is coming around the bend, is running the red light or whatever. And the people who have signed up for it are like gaga over the whole thing. They really like it. Mm. Like I said, I think it could be a massive safety breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as you're not getting a warning at every intersection that you're crossing through, like, ah!
Yeah, right.
You'll be okay.
Yeah. Well, cool, Sean. Thanks for that report. I think it's technologically interesting enough that we had to do something about it on the show.
Yeah. And it's one of those things, like I said, you need a lot of data points for all these cars to be coming along. And I think it's definitely a good thing that they're doing these tests now.
Yeah.
For sure.
So the last time we had you on, you were talking about the Hellcat. Right?
That was the Demon.
The Demon, all right.
Demon, yeah. So quite the
what was more interesting, the V2I or?
Well, interesting, I would say the Honda test, but if you're talking excitement, mm-hmm. definitely the Demon.
All right, just checking. I wanted to calibrate.
Yeah, you passed the test. Okay, we're going to take another quick break here, give a shout out to our friends at Lear and Bridgestone. We're going to bring Steve Purdy back on the set.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. And Carmen just told me we got a phone call from Clem. Let's bring it in.
This is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. My first car was a 41 Ford with a 59 AB block, two Stromberg 97 carburetors, Sandy B-Lawn headers, and in each tailpipe, I had a spark plug powered by a Model T vibrator coil, so you could go down the road, shut off the ignition, push the button, and it had flamethrowers out of each tail dual exhaust. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Clem.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah. So have you seen the flamethrower
kit? I've seen flamethrower kits before. Basically, it mounts a spark plug in the tailpipe, and you can kill the ignition, which stops the engine from burning fuel, which ends up getting pushed down the exhaust stream, and then that back spark plug will ignite it, and you'll shoot flames.
I'll bet that does wonders for your muffler.
Oh, yeah. Well, who needs a muffler?
Yeah.
My car, actually, I took them off.
Did you really?
Yeah, straight pipes.
Oh, is really? It loud?
It's loud, but it's not unbearable because, again, the engine doesn't make that much power, really, mm-hmm. and the block kind of...
Do your neighbors agree with you that it's not that loud?
Screw them. Right. No, in truth, it's not unbearable. It is a little loud, but not as loud as, like, a muscle car would be if you were running straight pipes.
Yeah. I wonder about this flamethrower thing. Could it go the wrong way and blow up your car?
I guess if you had the timing way off, it could backfire through the carburetor.
Didn't screw that down.
Not if you follow the Ford specs, you'll be fine.
Okay, it's the time of the show where we got to have Dr. Data.
Okay, so because I knew that we were going to have a vintage-oriented vehicle.
You're talking about Craig? He's not that old.
Vintage-oriented person.
Yeah. It's his soul. So anyway, I was looking at some information from CarMax, which largely sells used cars by and large. I mean, apparently you can buy some new cars from them. But so this is going to be a choice of what people who are looking for these cars want in the car. So, Katie, could you bring the first up? Okay, so the most desirable feature in a vehicle sold by CarMax, is it a navigation system, a rear-view camera, Bluetooth, leather seats, or a front seat heater?
Ooh, wow.
I don't see flathead engine.
Yeah, right. What does CarMax know?
Yeah.
That's actually below the list there. Yeah, yeah. They just didn't have room on the screen.
Number 476 on the list of...
I know what I would pick out of all that, but Craig, take a shot.
Boy.
What do you think?
I'm going to guess probably navigation, because I don't know how many people I see driving a Mercedes-Benz or a similar car that have their phone up to the side of their face rah, 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 when they're driving. Your car has standard Bluetooth. Just hook it up. It's not that hard. So I'm going to say navigation.
What do you think?
Well, I probably not front seat heater. I wish I had some demographics on who these people are, on the car buyer, but, you know, navigation is important. You know, if they're mostly youngsters, probably Bluetooth.
Oh, man, to me, it's easy. I want a seat heater.
But you're in Michigan. What about, southern climates?
Yeah, guess what? That. When it gets down to 68 degrees in Southern California, they want their seat heaters.
Yeah, you might be right on that, yeah.
I'm actually surprised at the responses in some ways.
Hmm. Why?
What are you going to pick, Gary?
Well, I
know the answer.
He's going to pick the right one.
See what he picks.
So we do have a winner.
Oh.
So... who do we think the winner might be?
Well, I think I'm the winner, of course.
I'm going to be modest and say Steve.
And you would be correct. So.
Oh, really? Really? Bluetooth.
So we'll look at the numbers. So show us what the numbers are here. So look at that. I mean, it's significant.
Wow, I was last.
You were dead last.
Oh. Is there a difference between last and dead last? I don't know.
if the demographics of these buyers were like me, that wouldn't be Bluetooth. But I'm guessing that most of the car buyers at... the source are youngsters.
What was the question again? Can you put that back?
The most desirable feature in a vehicle sold by CarMax.
Because I would think most people don't, from what I see, don't even know what Bluetooth is. They're driving around with the phone next to their face.
That's right.
I am surprised.
Well, obviously they didn't buy their car correctly from CarMax.
Mm. Or from the
but that Delta, I mean, I would have thought leather seats. Mm. Yeah, why would I think leather seats? Because if you're buying an older car, right, and you got leather seats, it's sort of like bragging rights. You know, I got leather.
Or you can get catskin leather.
That would be important.
You could, they could redo your car. But I'm just saying that would.
But my experience is the navigation systems in cars today are all inferior to what I have on my cell phone.
Absolutely true. So,
way inferior. Yeah. So I don't care if I have navigation or not, although it's important for me to have traffic information.
Well, your phone will give you that.
Yeah, it'll do just as well.
Google Earth or Waze, they got all that. Yeah. Okay, Gary, what do you think we should be talking about news-wise? What's really caught your attention?
Well, I thought what was sort of interesting is that Uber, the ride-hailing service, may go for an IPO. It's being valued at $120 billion,
wow,
which basically would be worth more than Ford, GM, and FCA combined.
Does that make sense?
Does that make sense? That's my question to you, Craig.
No,
it doesn't make sense to me.
The car companies actually make a real, a tangible product that they're selling. There's a lot of, they employ a lot of people. There are suppliers involved.
Mm.
I mean, Uber, they're just, I mean, it's, I'm not downplaying the significance of ride sharing, but I think they're separate. It shouldn't be that much.
Okay,
it's wrong.
But doesn't this sort of maybe go indicate that going forward, that things like this ride hailing app will become more valuable as people
and
buy fewer vehicles from Ford, FCA, and General Motors and everybody else in the world?
And that's also a recognition that Uber is leading the pack and is likely to be the number one provider as this market matures.
Mm-hmm. Because Lyft is gonna go for an IPO, and they're looking at $15.1 billion, which is just
okay.
Nothing. You know, I mean, it's just rounding error.
Well, Uber's around the world. I don't think Lyft is.
Right.
But even so, you know, to your point, Gary, companies like General Motors and Ford make billions of dollars in profit. Uber loses billions of dollars, and yet it's valued at way more than any of them. That's the mind-blowing thing in my
opinion. Do you guys think it's just people wanting to be involved in the next big thing, that investors just, oh, new technology, yeah, let's go, it's got to be great, woo, and just not thinking it through?
There is that, no question about it. But I think, you know, everybody's hoping, oh, I'm buying the next Apple. Mm-hmm. I'm buying the next Google. I'm getting in at the ground floor, and it's going to shoot to the moon.
Over $100 billion doesn't sound like a ground floor to me.
Well, I mean, you think about it another way. I mean, you know, the word Uber has come into the language sort of like Kleenex now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I'm going to take an Uber.
Genericized trade.
Right? I mean, and so it isn't like it's something that is mysterious and new and cool and coming. It's just like, you know, you got the app on your phone.
Call.
There you go.
Good point.
The other thing that caught my eye was, I guess it was last winter we had Simon Spruill on the show from Aston Martin. And so while we're in this financial discussion, so Aston
did an IPO,
and they thought that they were going to be making money hand over fist. And apparently a lot of short sellers are in the process of saying, we're not so thrilled about what you guys are up to, and we would like to make some money. And so I guess my question is, so let's see, shares have plummeted more than 20% since they started trading on October 2nd. And so they started out valued at $5.7 billion again. Not very much money compared to Uber. But so, I mean, what do you make of this, John? I mean, so here's Aston Martin, a legendary, vaunted British motor car manufacturer.
Niche, very niche.
Very niche, but presumably very, very capable and profitable in what it's doing, being toyed with by investors rather than by car enthusiasts.
Well, look, Aston wanted to do the IPO because it can't get enough money. It's got to do all this electrification stuff, too. Mm-hmm. That's going to cost a bundle. So it went to the stock market to try to raise a whole bunch of money, got, I don't know, a nice chunk of change. But what some savvy investors were going, this is a very niche company. Mm-hmm. It has to spend a fortune to electrify. And by the way, all this thing called autonomy is coming around. So if they want to play in that, they're going to have to invest in that. Or maybe autonomy is going to wipe out people's desire for sports cars. And on top of that, there's this thing called Brexit that could destroy all British industry. So why not short the stock? And from what you're saying, looks like they've made some tidy profits.
Mm-hmm. But would their electrification cost them that much? They are partnered with Daimler. Couldn't they get some of their...
Sure, but you know, Daimler's not going to give it to them.
They're
going to have to
cut
them
a sweet
from
deal,
them.
Right?
Well, I don't think it'll be sweet.
Yeah.
But sure, you can go out on the market and buy stuff, but you still have got to integrate it into your cars. Mm-hmm. And now you've got a bunch of piston head people. You've got a bunch of people who know how to build flathead V8s. Do they know anything about electrons? Maybe not. So now you got to go out and hire a bunch of electrical engineers that know this stuff.
Yeah, and there may be other partnerships out there, but like John says, I mean, you're going to have to pay for all of that, either in dilution of your uniqueness, basically, with Aston Martin or a company like that, or in any other way.
But they do have the Lagonda brand, right? I think it was at the Geneva show. They had some sort of, I forget the name of it. It was like a pod car. It was all electric. It was beautiful. Uh-huh. So maybe they could fork and have Lagonda do the one thing and Aston Martin can stick with.
You know, Andy Palmer, who used to be Big Muckety Muck, reported at Nissan, reported directly to Carlos Ghosn. He's now running Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. I think what he's been doing there is terrific. And Simon, one of our favorite guys in the industry, is working there as their head of communications and marketing. Mm-hmm. I think what Aston has achieved for being such a little company
it's remarkable.
Is really good.
Driven a lot of their products. And a few years ago, they were forgettable. But now they're legitimately nice. They're like the DB11 is excellent. You get the Superleggera. It's fast. It sounds amazing.
And the company has such an amazing heritage.
Yes.
That's what I appreciate. I appreciate that heritage.
Yeah. And they're beautiful cars.
Absolutely.
They just stop traffic. I mean, if you see a Ferrari go by, it's cool, whatever, but I'd rather an Aston.
Who's going to design it, Aston?
Mark Reichman.
Oh, I don't know him.
Yes.
He once upon a time worked at Ford.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Ford's still copying him, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was that grill thing, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I found this interesting quote from Klaus Frohlich, since we have a powertrain expert here on the show, who is a BMW board member for development, and he told this Go Auto, which apparently is this Australian publication or website, quote, "We have a spiral in Europe where every politician sees only one solution, diesel bashing. Mm. And he says, quote, "From a CO2 and customer perspective, a modern diesel is a very good solution, especially for heavy, high-performing cars." So basically saying, damn it, this diesel stuff is still good.
Well, I've always been a diesel fan, you know, from the old days of the Mercedes four-cylinder diesel in my brother's sedan, a little sedan. But I'm not an engineer. But to me, there is a lot of advantages to a diesel still. Particularly with modern technology for cleaning up the exhaust, you know, the Mercedes Bluetooth or whatever, not Bluetooth, Blue Tech.
Blue
diesel. Yeah. So, you know, to me, I'm still high on diesel.
Craig, you probably diesels have one great that you built in your garage.
Well, I like diesels. They're very nice. For you know, torque, fuel economy, et cetera, I would still take a good gasoline engine over a great diesel, personally. But I see where diesels, why people like diesels.
But what about an electric motor over a diesel engine?
I would probably, because like you said you were driving the Tesla Model X.
Yeah.
And I've driven electrics. I was just in the Kona Electric, for instance, Hyundai Kona. Electric is fantastic. On paper, electric is the best solution because it has practically no moving parts. You get instant torque. As long as you can have a battery with enough capacity, right, and you can charge it reasonably quickly, there's nothing there to break, really. It's all one unit, basically. So I like electrics, but I understand they don't work for a lot of people.
Well,
and I might take an electric over a diesel.
It seems to me that the diesel and the electric are a great combination. Look at the locomotive. Mm-hmm. You've got a big diesel engine generating electricity. Well, with an automobile, you could have this little tiny diesel running at a constant RPM, most efficient thing you could possibly have, running a generator for your electric car. But then again, as with most of these cases, you've got two separate powertrains to pay for. So the cost
money
goes up. But, you know, as far as efficiency is concerned, I would think that would be a charming powertrain.
I think diesels are sales-proof.
Not in pickup trucks in the U.S. market.
But, I mean,
for everything else.
For everybody.
For passenger vehicles,
I totally agree with you, Gary. I love them. I think they're great to drive. They're very expensive to clean up. You know, as Bob Lutz used to always say, you have to build this little chemical factory under the car to get the exhaust clean. And the writing's on the wall. Europe was the primary market for passenger car diesels, and they are turning against it.
And diesel will probably never transcend the scandals of Volkswagen and Audi so forth.
Are diesels as dirty if they're running on biodiesel as they are petroleum?
No. Biodiesel cleans it up.
Okay, so you...
Yeah,
if they could just figure that out, then.
Yeah.
So if Willie Nelson didn't turn to weed, he could have just continued with his bio-Willie.
Hey, we're getting towards the end. We got a few more questions and comments. In fact, we got a phone call. Carmen, let's bring in that other phone call.
Hey, John and the cast, got a quick question here. Has anybody seen the change of style of Ford spelling, you know, from the old English style to the black style on the sneak peeks that they showed several months ago on some of the upcoming vehicles, you know, with the traditional Ford spelling to the black style they had on those? Do you think that's coming? And one quick question on another thing. Can you guys give me your opinion of what, one or two things of what brought the downfall of the Ford, of the Chrysler Viper several years ago? Was it the price, the design, marketing? Thanks very much, and I hope I kept it under 30 seconds. Take care.
Good.
Great state of Michigan forever. Bye-bye.
Thanks, thanks. And you got two good topics in there. I don't know. Is Ford changing the script?
It's like the front end of the Raptor.
Yeah. Mm.
So they're using block letters.
Okay.
F-O-R-D.
Only on
F-O-R-D,
the Raptor.
That it's on the Raptor, and then on the... Here's the Bronco.
Yeah,
they've done that for years. The tailgates of the old trucks used to have it spelled.
Yeah,
right.
But this is interesting.
So this is you know, the 2020 or 2022
Who knows?
Yeah. The Bronco, I think, is 2020.
I think what the point is that basically they're making that move for trucks, right? Mm. And then you put the blue oval on the back, and you'll have that in the front.
I don't think they're going to change their logo. This is just model-specific graphics and design.
So if you have a big-ass grill, you just put something like that on there. Mm-hmm. Technical term.
Yeah.
And and my take on the Viper, all the items that he checked off were all correct. I mean, they all conspired to make that thing. Yeah.
Styling, price,
everything. And the other element
of
that.
Car, wasn't it?
The recent version is more sophisticated than the original. Mm-hmm. The original, you know, that was funny when we had Lutz here, because, you know, when the original Viper came out, they said, it doesn't have ABS, it doesn't have stability control, it doesn't have any of that crap. This is a driver. Well, now he's come clean. Yeah. They were trying to keep the cost down. They didn't want to put any of that in.
Yeah, right. And another issue is, you know, like the SSR, there's only a limited audience for that car.
The demand.
Again, we'll use the term niche. It's a niche vehicle, and maybe the demand had been satiated.
I think you're right.
Maybe, but I think price had more to do with it than anything else, because I want to say they raised the price like $25,000. Wow. So from one model year to the next, 25 grand.
Yeah.
That took out a lot of buyers.
Maybe they didn't charge enough, because like the Ford GT has been sold out, right?
Yeah, right?
And they just had an event. They announced today they're upping production of that by about 350 units. So,
of the GT?
Yeah. And so that's $500,000, right? So maybe they didn't price the Viper high enough.
Yeah.
Maybe. So what are the prices like on used Vipers, I wonder? That'd be an interesting study to go see what you could buy a used
Viper.
That's
a great point, Steve. Yeah. That'll tell you the story as to demand.
Right.
Look, we've burned up an hour. I think we could keep going. But in deference to our audience, I think we ought to wrap this up. Craig Cole, thanks so much for coming on the show. Awesome to have you here with all these bits and pieces of black.
Yeah.
This is good stuff. And it's old.
It's rusty.
You know, it's not like it's rusty. In fact, it looks like there's, you know, it looks like you got to polish that up, man.
Still standing there, maybe.
Yeah, there probably is. Right? This has been, like I said, through the hot tank. So the grease and the bulk of the crap's been flushed out, but it needs to be machined and cleaned again and gone through, inspected, which I haven't done yet.
Cool. Well, you better get on it.
I know.
Yeah, right.
Steve Purdy, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks.
And Gary, we'll just keep on doing this.
Yeah, let's do it next week.
Okay, we'll do it next week, and we invite all of you to join us then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by BorgWarner, propulsion solutions that support a clean, energy-efficient world.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.